Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, folks, this is Martin Popoff, author of 70 books on hard rock and heavy metal. I know it's a sad existence. You are listening to Talking Metal.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast, home of all things hard rock and heavy metal. I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. Now, let's get things started with the Talking Metal theme song, written by Rob Halford, Metal Mike, and Roy Z.
Hey, it's Mark Striegel of the Talking Metal Podcast. We have a great show for you today. This is a really special show. We have Martin Popoff back on the show for the first time in a long time. He was on 2 or 3 times back, I would say, had to be 6, 7 years ago at this point, and delivered some great episodes that the listeners always loved, and it's been far too long for him to have been away from the podcast, and I'm so psyched that he's back here to talk about one of our favorite bands, Motorhead. We're going to be focusing, for the most part, on the early Motorhead, the Fast Eddie Clark, Filthy Animal, Lemmy Kilmister lineup, the original three, if you will, who delivered us those great, great records that have just held the test of time. And Martin has a new book out, which he's going to tell us all about, that focuses on this era of Motorhead. It's a just wonderful read for anybody who loves to dive into what went on when they made these records, what went on in great detail within the band, the dynamics of the band. I mean, it's all there, you know, the rise of this band and the internal workings of the band. It's all there in Martin's new book, which again, he's going to tell us all about the book. It's linked through today's show notes. If you go to talkingmetal.com for the show notes of 678 episodes, folks, that's a lot. We have the show notes up, and you can check it out there. And and you can buy it by linking with our show notes. We prefer you to do that. Catch up with us at the Rock and Pod Expo in Nashville on August 26th. We hope to see you there. Go make a donation to the Rock and Pod GoFundMe page. I don't get any of that money. It's just helping put on the event. it would mean a lot to me if you made a donation. And when you made the donation, you mentioned that you're a Talking Metal listener. Even if it's a $5 donation, that would be great. And we'll have that linked. It's GoFundMe.com/rock, the letter N, Pod Expo. And again, we'll have that link through today's show notes on TalkingMetal.com. So after Martin, by the way, the Lemmy stories continue because we have Pin Doll on, and this is a guy who has a band called Barbed Wire Dolls. They're kind of a punk band, you know, but I think metalheads will like them. And Lemmy signed this band to his Motorhead label, and he was friends with these guys right up until he passed on. So Pin had some great stories. I was very impressed with the interview. If you're into the Eagles of Death Metal, which, you know, is not a metal band, as we all know, but it's a cool band. I like them a lot. And an incredible story with what went on in Paris a couple of years ago with them. And so we hear from, Pin tells us a little bit about his relationship with those guys too. So it's a really fascinating listen. So after the Martin Popoff interview, stay tuned for an interview with Pin Doll from Barbed Wire Dolls and check out their new music. We'll talk about that during the interview with Pin. Make a PayPal donation. Keep us going here. Keep us afloat. PayPal donations have been really thin lately. I would love a PayPal donation. It would be great. My PayPal account is strigelmark@gmail.com. strigelmark@gmail.com. Leave us a review on iTunes. I'd appreciate that. Go to the comments section on TalkingMetal.com and let us know what you think of this episode, what you think of the news stories we're posting. Visit TalkingMetal.com. That's a great way to support the site. And we may have a sponsor coming up. Every now and again, we get advertisers, sponsors. If that happens for us, you know, I make literally like $30 to $40 an episode when we have a sponsor. But that's more than I usually make with the donations and stuff. So when we do get the sponsor, go support them. It's very important. And they usually track the traffic we're sending them with codes and stuff like that. So stay tuned for that. I hope it comes a reality, this sponsor. And on that note, oh, one other thing. Leave us a message on the hotline. It's 973-757-1917. 973-757-1917. Leave us a message today. Let me know what you thought of this episode or whatever. Let's talk some metal. Leave me a message. You know I play them on the podcast. And without further ado, here is Martin Popoff with some great talk about Motorhead and rock and roll in general, heavy metal in general. Hey, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and on the line, a guy we haven't spoken with in quite some time, Martin Popoff. Martin, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're back on with us. We have a great new book by you, Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers, The Rise of Motorhead by Martin Popoff. And I want to just go right into this right now. I mean, there's so much great stuff in this, but it's primarily about the rise of Motorhead. It is, we're talking mostly about Phil Taylor, Eddie Clark, Fast Eddie Clark, and Lemmy. And those first, four studio records, right? Five studio records.
Five and a live album, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to get into those, but first, just you cover a lot of the prehistory of these three guys leading up to the great Motorhead. Let's talk about Lemmy. We always hear that he was Hendrix's guitar roadie, and from your book, I kind of got a slightly different picture as to what he did with Hendrix. He technically wasn't on stage tuning up guitars or carrying guitars around, was he?
No, and it's interesting. You mentioned this sort of prehistory because I'm thinking, oh man, Mark's asking about the prehistory. I'm thinking Fast Eddie Clark had barely any prehistory, and, right. and Phil had barely any prehistory. So Lemmy has a strange prehistory. I mean, he starts getting into rock and roll in the late 50s, actually. And, you know, one of the heartbreaking things about Lemmy, I mean, later on he says he had all his records stolen and he had all these rock and roll records stolen or whatever. But so he just works his way through all that garage rock era, and then he gets on with this Sam Gopal guy and they do this crazy album. And yeah, he's like sort of loitering around, almost squatting around, you know, and just hanging around and doing drugs and selling drugs and all that stuff. And he right. gets in with Jimmy and, you know, it's acid this and acid that. But yeah, you kind of get the feeling that there's a little bit of like probably like some myth making that went on with what Lemmy actually did. And he essentially seemed like he was like a roadie, but who knows if he was all that paid and it wasn't like a regular official gig kind of thing. But he definitely hung around with Jimmy and did a lot of acid with Jimmy.
Kind of almost part of the entourage, maybe, you know, Jimmy.
Yeah, he was not a guitar tech, but, you know, he's a pretty imposing looking guy. You wonder if he's probably serves a little bit of a security role as well.
Right.
You know, with his laconic sense of humor and whatnot, but quite a colorful past. And then, of course, he goes into Hawkwind and he's like this legendary dude in Hawkwind, you know, yeah. crazy drug band. And he's the bassist,
right?
And he's. Yeah, so, well, psychedelic, and you know what they call Hawkwind is blanga sometimes, okay. which is almost like this crazy, critically mass, moving forward, noisy space rock
right.
stuff, right? So post psych, I suppose, and you know he's in there, sort of critically in that classic Hawkwind period of 72 to 74 sort of thing, and then yeah, he's basically trying to get into Canada. Hawkwind's on tour in the States,
right.
and he gets busted for drugs and he gets sort of unceremoniously kicked out of the band because he's more of a liability at that point.
Right.
So he gets spiteful and like, I'll show all you guys, kind of like David Roth, his solo career, and decides that, you know, I'm going to make the most badass band you can imagine. And hence we have Motorhead.
Right. So, Let's just back up just a little bit. Now, he was a guitar player, essentially, and joined Hawkwind without possibly ever having played bass before. And a lot
yeah.
of that sound that later becomes Motorhead is in part that he is a guitar player playing bass unlike any other bass player. Is that, do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, I have to tread a little lightly because I'm doing this a little bit from memory. But yeah, there was the whole idea that he just sort of like became the bassist because the bass was left behind kind of thing.
Right, yep.
And yeah, so generally, yeah, what we get out of Lemmy, I guess the most important part of the story is that he does end up with this sound and he sticks with this sound where it's this, as he described it to me once, you know, turn the bass right up, off, turn the treble right up kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
And it becomes almost like this rhythm guitar sound. That goes through it. And Eddie throughout the book talks about how it was so difficult to locate his guitar within yeah. this when there's really no bass player. It's essentially this band has two rhythm guitar players and a drummer. And it's funny, the vocalist, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, as his voice got gruffer and gruffer, and he got sort of less articulate over the years, his voice almost became like a third rhythm guitar in that
true.
Band.
I never thought of that.
You know, yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, and so yeah, you can understand the challenges that he talks about in his charming way throughout the book
yeah.
about trying to find a place to put his guitar in all this mess.
And I definitely want to talk more about that specific thing and Eddie Clark, but the song Motorhead predates the band Motorhead. And while we're still kind of on this Hawkwind era chat here, can you tell us a little bit about the actual song Motorhead?
Yeah, so there's this song, and it becomes the penultimate song, and he names it after it. It's kind of like a little bit of the old Black Sabbath, Van Halen, record so good we had to name it twice kind of thing. And so this song carries forward, and it becomes the name of the album, the name of the band. And, you know, yeah, and at that 1977 juncture, you know, it's not even the most heavy metal song really on that album. It's almost like a floundering around punk song in a way, and done in that sort of, you know, bad production on purpose sound that you get on that record, you know, part on purpose, part just because of speed and just doing it all through the night kind of thing. But it's a song that probably, you know, it becomes sort of a classic, but it's a little bit of a almost like a silly chopped at the knees sort of song. It's yeah. Not that great. It's almost like a slightly too melodic punk song.
Gotcha. And did he sing this? That I mean, he was the bassist in Hawkwind, but did he sing on that song when he was in Hawkwind?
I believe so. You're testing my memory again here. Yeah. I'm not quite sure. I don't quite remember
I think
all this,
in the book
but
you
I
say there
so.
Might be two Hawkwind versions of it. I think one where he sings it and one where he doesn't or something like that.
Yeah, it's a little complicated. There's Lost Johnny as well, and then there's like a single version, and then of I believe of this, and then maybe an album version. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah.
I believe that's how this sort of transition takes place.
Cool. And we are talking with Martin Popoff. He is the author of Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers, The Rise of Motorhead, which deals with that potent era of Phil Filthy Animal Taylor, Fast Eddie Clark, and of course Lemmy Kilmister as that three-piece that gave us all that original Motorhead stuff. Now, you know, as a kid, I was a young kid, and I was getting into hard rock and heavy metal pretty hardcore at a very young age, and at that time in the early 80s, you know, maybe even mid 80s, 83, 84, when I discovered Motorhead, it was obviously through the Ace of Spades record, which was a really big record here in the States. But unlike a lot of the other bands I was discovering, it was very hard for me at that time to go back and figure out what the heck came first, because there was all sorts of EPs and singles and strange records, you know, that predated Overkill, and it was all very confusing pre-internet to try to figure out what was the first Motorhead record. And in your book, you shed some light on that. They kind of had two first records.
Yes. So essentially, when it came to the albums, which is kind of the most important thing, they get on with UA, United Artists, and they do this stuff, and it kind of crashes in flames. It doesn't happen,
and so they go over
to Chiswick. Yeah, Fast Eddie's not there. Larry Wallace is there,
right?
And then also there's some complication with Phil as a drummer. So essentially, what happens is, you know, the clean start becomes the Chiswick album, the notorious classic Motorhead album,
self-titled.
The lo-fi on purpose album. But when they start to make it in the UK, because let's face it, I mean, they aren't making it anywhere else because, you know, none of these records are getting released in the US or Canada or any of that stuff. When they start to make it, UA puts out, as part of their On Parole or Rockfile series, they put out Motorhead On Parole. So it has these versions of you know, half of it's kind of versions of songs that are off the Motorhead album, and the production's actually better. I mean, it's more conventional production, but that comes later, and that confuses everybody, kind of like the whole AC/DC, you know, Dirty Deeds. And I know you helped me with my AC/DC book.
Right.
That was so cool. That's a little bit of news. That's actually not out yet. It's probably not even announced on Amazon yet, but there's an AC/DC book that Mark was a contributor in.
Yeah, honored to be a part of it.
But basically, yeah, so that's coming out in the fall. But yeah, I mean, the whole Motorhead, the On Parole and all that thing reminds me of that whole
right.
Dirty Deeds,
so,
Thunder Cheap story, right?
Yeah, so they put out the Motorhead, the self-titled record, which is essentially, and again, on this record are the three, Phil, Eddie, and Lemmy. But it's essentially songs that are from the past that Eddie wasn't involved with creating, and for the most part Phil wasn't involved with creating these songs. Most of the songs were on this other record that they recorded, which had been shelved, but then the label releases it after the Motorhead record starts taking off. So
yes. And it's basically, you know, it's a little more covers related. It's a little more traditionally conservatively recorded. So in a certain way, it's not as intense as the Motorhead thing. It doesn't have the same storyline that Motorhead miraculously. I don't know how they did this, but between Motorhead, you know, transitioning into Overkill and Bomber, they do maintain this ethic of this dirty on purpose biker rock, greaser rock sound. So it just becomes a thorn in his side, and it becomes another one of these things that makes Lemmy, you know, a cynic all through his life about the business.
Right. So the three guys, the Motorhead record is out, On Parole is out, but the three guys as a unit, as a trio, for the first time, really start working together on writing and creating music for their next record, which in some ways, if you want to look at it, you know, through a different pair of glasses, it's probably truly the first Motorhead record, and it's called Overkill. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I really think that's where, you know, everything solidified and you know, arguably, you know, they never make a better record, in a certain sense. I mean, Ace of Spades is always considered the great Motorhead record, and actually, you know, Bomber is considered a little bit of a setback compared to Overkill, but Everything comes together, you know, in absolutely fine fashion in Overkill. I remember buying that album as a new release in one of our famous, you know, hook out of school, let's drive down to Spokane, Washington from my small town of Trail, BC, and go by imports.
Wow.
And I remember just flipping through the racks, flip through, you know, to the M's, and all of a sudden, you know, Motorhead as this black and white, dour, you know, punky, simple thing just explodes in full color before your eyes. And I remember jumping up in the air and almost hitting my head on a beam in this you know, small old building in this shop. It was the original location of Strawberry Jam's Records in Spokane, and seeing that and buying that and just loving it. I mean, Motorhead had, I mean, it was essentially, you know, a quantum leap forward. You know, certain things about that record are very important in terms of the influence on bands like Metallica through the idea of a you know, a constant double bass pattern through a song like Overkill. Very heavy album. You know, I've often had this discussion with people about what are the heaviest records ever of the 1970s. And, you know, it really comes down to things like Overkill, Bomber, maybe a Heavy Load record, the first record, High Speed on High Tilt on High Level or whatever it's called. You know, maybe the Ram Jam album, maybe a couple Ram of Black Jam, Sabbath albums, maybe Deep Purple in rock. But you know, down this sort of path of the other game we used to play is what's the first album where every song is heavy?
Yeah.
And I remember the first one of those being AC/DC, Let There Be Rock.
Wow, yeah.
Although not the first one. The first one was Rainbow Rising.
Okay.
AC/DC, Let There Be Rock, the Sex Pistols album. But it was also, in a sense, all three Motorhead albums. They put out an album in 77. They put out Overkill in March 79. They put out Bomber in, I think it's October 79. So, you know, in some ways, Overkill, one could definitely argue that it's the heaviest damn record of the entire 70s.
Yeah, absolutely. And you get into this in the book, the song Overkill with that double bass. And I mean, I remember interviewing Mike Portnoy about probably almost 10 years ago at this point, and he brought up that song as just this revolutionary song for drumming, and how that double bass went constantly throughout that entire song, influencing not just the thrash metal scene that was to come, you know, some years later, but so many different drummers, from Mike Portnoy. I mean, you listen to Tommy Lee and that double bass sound. I mean, that's where it started. That's ground zero for double bass going constantly, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And Phil, you know, God love him. I interviewed him before his death. I mean, the sort of interesting thing, odd thing, sad thing about writing this book is that I was almost finished this entire book, and both Lemmy and Phil were still alive. Nobody was dying. Nobody was dead yet when I did this book. I was literally finished, and I had to kind of like scramble and sort of say what I wanted to say in a eulogy sense at the end about two guys out of all three that this book is about. But anyways, I did talk to Phil, you know, before his death, and we talked at length about that. And, you know, he was an interesting guy. He sort of like was just, you know, kind of dumbfounded at all the accolades, you know, poured upon him by all these, you know, extreme metal people. And Mike Portnoy is extreme in a certain sense too. I mean, this is extreme progressive rock he comes from, and he's telling you about this, which is a beautiful thing that you guys talked about that. But also, you know, definitely the Motorhead guys. I mean, the Metallica guys have talked to me at length about the, you know, the value of Motorhead and Anthrax and whatnot. But yeah, so this was, you know, and it's funny. I've brought up with all those guys. Another one is Pat Travers Hammerhead. You know, it's not double bass all the way through, but there are double bass things going on in the world, right? Not many. But this was double bass all the way through, and you know, and I remember bringing that up with Phil, and he barely even sort of it registered. It's like, you know, F me, you're right, you know, that's right, you know. It's like it's almost like he was acknowledging it for the first time. But
yeah, that's how it comes.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, I mean, it's very tragic if you think about Phil. I mean, essentially. He never did anything ever again after Motorhead.
Yeah.
You know, he was never heard from again. And Fast Eddie had a few things he got into, you know, most of it was lower level, except for Fastway, which was a great thing that he did right after Motorhead. But Phil just never ended up doing much more with music. And in a weird way that you gather from the book, it almost suits his personality that he was just sort of this outsider that just found himself in the middle of this metal storm.
Yeah. Yeah. His past story that you lay out in the book is very interesting too. We don't have to get into it now, but you know, he wasn't really even a music guy. He just kind of started drums to get out of trouble. He had a military drum teacher, I think, was a military drummer. So there's such great stories in this. We're talking about Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers, The Rise of Motorhead by Martin Popoff. And Martin, let me ask you about the producer, just a legendary guy. He worked on Overkill and Bomber. His name was Jimmy Miller. And I mean, this guy, The Stones, Sticky Fingers, Beggar's Banquet, worked with Clapton, Blind Faith, Traffic. I mean, this guy is just legendary guy who had stuff out in the 60s and early 70s. And how, I mean, at that time, was he down on his luck that he ended up with Motorhead? I mean, is that, no disrespect towards Motorhead, but it seems like it was kind of a big switch from going from these major high profile superstar bands to ending up with Motorhead to do the Overkill record.
That's very interesting. I've never thought of it that way, and that's a really, really good question, and I really don't know the answer. But, you know, just off the top of my head now, kind of reflecting on it, okay, so what we have happening here is, okay, number one, and there's kind of stories throughout the book in this, and it's sort of amusing and tragic at the same time, because Motorhead are notorious F-ups themselves. No, Jimmy Miller is in the throes of a heroin addiction, and he's disappearing and not showing up and falling asleep in the ladies' room and all this kind of stuff. But the other thing that's interesting, just thinking about it, is that, you know, you mentioned those great artists. It's almost like Motorhead being the punk rock type A, you know, like almost a volatile form of type A punk rock personalities themselves to a T, the entire trio. It's like they obviously impose their will on him, and they don't get records that sound like anything that he would want to do or does or did.
Right.
You know, all these classic records, they still get biker rock, and which is crazy because obviously, you know, the combination of these guys being the way they are, strong-willed, and him being in the throes of heroin addiction, they basically run roughshod over him because this is not the kind of record he would ever want to make. He must have been horrified at what he was hearing. And yet, you know, this kind of music comes out of him, this absolutely you know, groundbreaking, crazy, why would anybody do this on its way to Venom, on its way to black metal production ethic. And to have that coming out of that guy just seems like the classic kind of Motorhead absurdity.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, and like you said, there's some funny stories about Jimmy Miller in the book, but they're also kind of tragic and sad when you think about them because you know, he had a terrible heroin addiction which I think eventually ended up killing him in the early 90s. But you know, it's interesting, the Motorhead guys, it was almost too much for them at times, the addictions that Jimmy Miller had. But, you know, Lemmy was never a guy who was into drugs like that. And drugs were a big part of Motorhead. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Lemmy was always a notorious and, I must say, articulate, you know, protester against the evils of heroin. But yet he sort of found this toxic chemical balance in his own body that he figured he could be a functioning alcoholic speed freak and still get through life. But, you know, he is essentially only getting through because also we sort of, you know, get through Eddie's charming sort of explanations of things that we do realize that Lemmy had sort of a lazy streak to him as well. Right. A lazy streak combined with a I don't give a damn streak and I'm somewhat of a rock star streak and I'm an outlaw streak. So all of this combines that Lemmy doesn't really do enough of the heavy lifting within this band, and it kind of falls to Eddie to do it. And Phil in his sort of, you know, it almost seems like he gets like he has this responsible streak where he like pops out of his stupor and realizes like we got to run this band. And you know, the crazy, you know, the management musical chairs all throughout as well. But so Lemmy you know, he writes some great songs and he's an incredible lyricist, but he writes some great songs against the evils of heroin, and yet he's a constant, you know, heavy boozer and speed freak, and the other guys are definitely boozers as well. But yeah, you know, I think Lemmy, you know, he hints at the fact that he's seen too many people, you know, fall to heroin along the way. And Jimmy Miller turns out to be just another one.
Yeah. And the book has all this stuff, the girl school connection and the you know, whole backstory behind all the records, including Ace of Spades, which was technically the first American release. I mean, you mentioned coming down to America and getting Overkill, but that was, of course, in the import section. Back in the day, there used to be, in certain record stores, you could get imports. But in your mainstream record stores, the first Motorhead record to ever appear would have been Ace of Spades. And was there a different label that picked up Ace of Spades? I can't remember. In the States, I guess there would have been.
Well, okay, so I'm from Canada, and again, I'm doing this a little bit from memory, right. But I mean, basically, their Bronze's distributor was always Mercury. So if it was Ace of Spades, yeah, it probably would have been a Mercury album, I believe. And you know, and from that point on, the records were out regularly. And I think Canada kind of got the releases ahead of time. You know, I swear I must have been the first person in BC to ever be in the Motorhead Bangers, because I remember joining the Motorhead Bangers. there's the Saxon Militia, Metal Militia, or whatever it was called, and the Buffalo Sabres fan club, all at the same time in the late 70s, yeah, right?
I think you mentioned that in the opening to the book, actually.
Yeah. But also, I believe the records also came out in Canada a little early. I think we might have had Ace of Spades or Motorhead came out. My brain's a little scrambled, but yeah. But essentially, we were learning about these bands through Sounds and later Kerrang, but Sounds and Melody Maker and getting all these records as imports. My Bomber was an import. It was the colored vinyl. I think my Overkill was the colored vinyl. You know, Jerry Braun liked to do this from Bronze. It was a very haphazard release schedule when it came to these records coming out in the States. But Ace of Spades was the one that hit. Didn't hit big. It never went gold in the States, but it was a big record in the UK. I mean, Motorhead were a big band in the UK. And going back to your earlier question about Jimmy Miller, you know, Motorhead were, you know, if you're sitting there looking at this in the isolated, climes of the island, Motorhead were pretty much a pretty big band.
Yeah.
I mean, they were in the news all the time. They were always in the clubs and they were always in the press for one notorious reason or another. So locally they were a big band, but they never made it in the States because they just never had the proper release schedule. And I remember even, I don't want to step too far forward, but I believe Eddie talks about in the book as well, this whole idea about how, you get over for Iron Fist and the record's not in the shops at all. And it's just the typical, thing you just kind of glean from the whole Motorhead story that it was just like a comedy of errors constantly. Yeah.
You know, and to talk a little bit about Eddie's story with this band and leading up to his exit from the band. I mean, one thing we've always been told on the internet and word of mouth and blogs and articles was, well, the reason Fast Eddie Clark left Motorhead was specifically because of the duet that they were doing with Wendy O. Williams, and that was what caused him to exit the band. However, in reading the book, it seems to me that it all maybe kind of came to a head at that recording session, but there were problems that were kind of going on all along. I mean, you mentioned that Eddie was never happy with the guitar sound that he was getting. He would do even bring in Strats and Les Pauls and do double tracks with both guitars trying to get this guitar sound. And there's one time where Leslie West plays through his amps and he can't believe that Leslie's getting this great sound when he's just been so frustrated with his sound. So it almost seems like that was a big issue. It seems as though Eddie's management of, helping manage the band, and then possibly even the fact that he became a producer on the Iron Fist record, which is the record that came out, the next studio record after Ace of Spades. And was resentment building towards Eddie because of all these roles that he was playing on the Lemmy Phil side? And was he so upset with his sound that resentment was building within him? I mean, what's your thoughts on that, his exit?
Well, that's a very eloquent summation of the whole thing. And as you were saying that, I'm just thinking again, comedy of errors and just the weird chemistry of these three guys coming together, two complete enigmas who have no past, plus Lemmy, who has a past. And so they're coming together. Two of the guys, actually three of the guys, damn it, absolutely, all three of the guys have no idea about heavy metal or what heavy metal is or why are we doing heavy metal and are we heavy metal? And believe it or not, we're the heaviest metal band in the whole world.
Right.
I mean, they're very heavy. They're a very heavy band. But none of these guys think like heavy metal people. They don't like heavy metal. They don't listen to heavy metal. So they have this problem with the sound, with Lemmy's sound. Lemmy is loud and abrasive and sounds like a guitar, and everybody wishes this band would have a bass player, but they don't. So Eddie's got that problem. there's the money problems constantly. There's the being worked to death, and while you're being worked to death, you're doing speed and you're drinking.
And Phil gets in some fights, and they have to cancel tours, which Eddie was really
pissed off about. He screws up his hand. You know, they're basically chaotic, you know, anarchic punk rockers, and they're being worked to the bone by management, by the label, by themselves, and they feel like. They kind of realize, I believe there's even a spot in the book somewhere, I'm just going by memory a little bit, but there's this idea that it's kind of funny, but they realize that the only time they can make a living is when they're playing live, because they're not making anything off of the records, kind of thing.
Yep, that is.
Yeah,
we're always
right?
anxious to get back out on the road, because that's again where they made their money.
Yeah, so this is frazzling nerves and wearing them out, and then there's this idea that, hey, if we get Eddie to produce the record, we don't have to pay a producer. So Eddie now has, you know, it's time for Iron Fist. The band is not particularly inspired. They're very tired and overworked, and Eddie now has to wear two hats. And as you mentioned, all of a sudden, what also happens is Lemmy's predilection for Lemmy and the Women is a very interesting story, because he's a great womanizer. He famously says, oh, I'm a total slut. Everybody knows what's going on and understands and all this. But he also is very respectful of women in a certain sense that he loves the idea when women become rockers. He loves women rockers. He just loves to see them participate. This goes all the way from Girl up through Wendy O. Williams, which you're going to talk about, all the way up to Skunk and Anzi. So essentially, you know, at this one point, it's like, oh, Wendy O. Williams, we're going to do this duet with Wendy O. Williams. And Eddie basically thinks that this is debasing ourselves. We have to be more of a serious band. We're serious musicians. That's the other interesting thing that goes through this band, is that they consider themselves serious musicians, and they never get any respect. Nobody else considers them serious musicians, right? So Eddie is saying, you know, this is stupid. We got to stop this novelty stuff, these EPs, Motorhead, Girl School, whatever. And so here comes another one. So it comes to a head in Toronto, and en route to the Palladium in New York, Lemmy wants to do this. He's got a little bit of a lust/romantic interest with Wendy. And, you know, as Eddie explains that they're wearing whatever, Wendy Williams or plasmatic shirts, and they're egging Eddie on. And it's like you could tell possibly Brian Robertson from Thin Lizzy is waiting in the wings.
Yeah.
It's a little bit vague. But Eddie sees the writing on the wall, and he's getting really ticked off at this whole thing. And they're egging him on. And there's this sort of funny episode where, as Eddie explains, you know, we get to the Palladium and they're in their dressing room, and I'm stuck in the boiler room with like a chair and a table, and there's a bottle and a line of something on an amp, and that's my exit or that's my goodbye present.
They made him sound check separately at that show. They wouldn't even sound check.
Yeah, and he plays this show, and I guess it turns out to be his last show, essentially. So. You know, all of this comes to a head, and again, it's Keystone Cops, it's Comedy of Errors. Like these guys are just like winging it, making it up as they go along. There's only three of them. You know, it's not a band of five people, and they're not all completely functioning. The most functioning of the guys who seems to be given a damn at all is Eddie, and all of a sudden he's the guy out of the band.
Yeah, and so this whole story again that I just always hear about, well, Wendy O. Williams broke up the original Motorhead, not exactly correct, right?
Well, I mean, it is correct if you say that, you know, Eddie leaves because of this story. But it is silly. I mean, it's like it was going to be, a single, Stand By Your Man, that's it, Tammy Wynette, and, you know, big deal. But in essence, I mean, it is the straw that breaks the camel's back, and Eddie is gone. And that's the end of the classic lineup. It's not the first Motorhead lineup, as we realize in the book. There's all this again, Comedy of Errors with Larry Wallace and Lucas Fox and stuff that kicks off the band. But at this point, you know, I really feel that I'm one of the guys that sort of stands with Lemmy, that even though this book is about the original and it's the quote classic lineup, I think they make albums every bit as good as those original albums as time goes on. And they're one of the examples that I always fight tooth and nail. You know, when I'm talking about bands that I think that are making their best music now, yes, I'm one of those guys that stands with Lemmy and says the last five Motorhead albums are just as good as the first five, if not better.
Wow. Wow. So Motorhead ends that original trio lineup, and Brian from Thin Lizzy comes in and finishes that tour and goes on to record Another Perfect Day with them. And this, can you talk a little bit about Brian? I mean, this is a kind of a big deal guy who's stepping into this band, right?
Yeah. So Brian comes from Thin Lizzy, which is a very respected, but much smoother rocking, heavy metal band, hard rock band from the past than Lizzy. And so he comes in, and the thing about Brian is he's definitely not a smooth guy. He's a crazy fighting, drinking, party guy. And he has, you know, as much trouble, he's as notorious right from the start. But the other thing that happens with him is this silly stuff about how, you know, he's coming just like Motorhead, oddly, you know, poetically, and I'm only thinking about this now, which is quite a deep thought. It's not my thought, I'm just reflecting on it, but Thin Lizzy and Motorhead both denigrate heavy metal, and yet they are heavy metal in a sense, and Brian is coming from another band just like Motorhead that has no sort of obvious connection or love of heavy metal. So he comes in and he expresses his not being part of heavy metal by wearing shorts and sneakers, yeah, on stage, and putting his headband on and having short hair. He cuts his hair all of a sudden. He doesn't look like a rocker anymore. And this ticks Lemmy off because, you know, Lemmy wants to have that black leather jacket image of the band. So he's there doing that. They also put out a record that, you know, now stands as a Motorhead classic, and I loved it from the start, but a lot of people thought that the guitar work was just a little too clean on it, and the production was a little too clean on it. I love Another Perfect Day. It's almost my favorite Motorhead album.
Yeah, I'm a fan of that record too, but I think we are in the minority, definitely, and I mean, even Lemmy, I think, said it was one, if not his least favorite Motorhead record.
Yeah, but sometimes, I mean, I don't know, with that guy, I mean, he could go from one end to another. I mean, sometimes he could say he really likes it, right?
Yeah.
And definitely has some great Lemmy lyrics. There's some amazing lyrics on there. But so they put out one record. It's almost like they're Black Sabbath Born Again. It's one record with the radically different, mm-hmm, lineup at I think it's the same year, isn't it? 1983.
I think so.
But so they do this one album. And Brian is summarily trounced from the band. He's gone for all of these myriad different reasons. And then hence what happens is we get that transition into the Wurzel and the Phil Campbell era. And then Wurzel falls away and we get, I think, something like 25 years of a very consistent lineup.
Right. Right. Yeah. Great stuff. Again, the book is Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers: The Rise of Motorhead. Martin, the title of the book, Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers, I know the answer to this, but can you fill the listeners in on where that title comes from?
Yeah, I mean, I have this sort of idea when I think of book titles. I mean, I've done 70 books now, and I do like this idea. I have a UFO book called Shoot Out the Lights, and, you know, I love the idea of, like, cross-referencing bands a little bit and giving a little bit of a nod to some other band. But that is obviously a big awesome, heavy, early ZZ Top song, Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers from 1973. And, of course, Motorhead covered it. So, and they were Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers. So there's all your levels for you. I love ZZ Top, one of my favorite bands of all time. Motorhead covered them, and Motorhead are Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers.
And it's a unique Motorhead song, even, you know, it's a cover, but also Fast Eddie Clark sings some lead on that song, too, which I believe is the only time he ever did that.
That's right. You're testing my memory a little bit, yeah. but I believe the cool thing about the original ZZ Top version is that Dusty and Billy both sing. It's like a duet back and forth. It's a call and response. And if I'm not wrong on this, Lemmy and Eddie do the call and response on the Motorhead version. Am I right about that?
You are right. Yeah. It's kind of hard to track it down. It is up on YouTube right now, but it doesn't seem to be on iTunes or Spotify or anything like that. But if you go to YouTube, you can hear it. And Martin, yeah, a great book. We highly recommend it. We're going to have a link up in today's show notes on talkingmetal.com where you can purchase this book. Highly recommended. Martin's website is, what is it, martinpopoff.com?
Absolutely it is.
Yeah, we'll have that linked too. And Martin, I see on Facebook every now and again, what's the best social media place to catch up with you? Is it Twitter?
Yeah, Facebook? I haven't been much of a Twitter guy. And Facebook, yeah, the funny thing about Facebook is I ran up against that 5,000 friend limit, and it's caused me to just like be a little down on it, and I haven't been keeping up that well. But yeah, I'm on Facebook. Unfortunately, people can't friend me anymore. It's very annoying getting all these friend requests. I hope they change that.
Yeah.
But no, I'm there, and yeah, martinpopoff.com for all the latest books. And there's every time I have a new book come out, it eventually goes up there, and the latest up there are the Rush album by album, which again, you know, thank you very much. You helped me on the second one that I did of those, which is the AC/DC album by album. So Mark's a part of that.
I can't wait
and
to
that
read
comes
that.
Out in Yeah, that comes out in October. And as I was telling you before we got on the air, I'm doing a Pink Floyd one, just like the AC/DC and the Rush one.
Great.
So that's out. And I've also done a thrash trilogy, Hit the Lights. The second one's called Caught in a Mosh. That just went up, and I'm just about to give my layout guy the third and final of that trilogy, which will be called Tornado of Souls, the Thrash's Titanic Clash, which will cover the years 86 to 91. So there'll awesome. Be a thrash trilogy to go along with my New Wave of British Heavy Metal trilogy, which are all kind of designed the same way. So yeah, lots happening.
Yeah, I have dozens of your books. I highly recommend all of them, including this new one. We're talking about Beer Drinkers and Hellraisers, The Rise of Motorhead. Martin, you know, people have called me a metal expert, but in my mind, you're the metal expert's metal expert. You really have such a deep knowledge of this art form known as hard rock and heavy metal. And where do we go from here? I mean, we're 40 plus years into this, approaching 50, actually, if not 50. Where does hard rock and heavy metal go in the future? Are we kind of at the end of an era? Is this the twilight of this art form?
Well, you know, I thank you for saying that, but you know, you got to realize also, I really feel like I haven't kept up. I'm 54 years old, right? So I feel like I haven't been keeping up. I mean, we debate this. We had a magazine up here in Canada called Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles, Tim Anderson, Mark Roman, all these guys, right? And so we ran this magazine from 94 to 2000, and we all sort of say that around the year 2000, you know, going forward a little bit, that's when it started getting so out of control that there were so many bands out all the time. And then we get into the revolution in the industry where CDs are gone. You know, there's not trucks full of plastic anymore. You know, there's a brief era where it's downloading. It was a brief era. It's not downloading anymore. It's a streaming life now, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So it's a Spotify world now. It's streaming. It's YouTube. Lots has changed in the business. I feel like I haven't really kept up. So thank you for calling me a metal expert, but really, I feel like I'm a metal historian. I have my thing. I know metal quite well up until about the year 2000, but that's 17 years ago now, right?
Yeah.
So Where is it going? I mean, it's interesting you ask that because there's a lot of debate lately. I'm part of this email group with a bunch of email people, and we are with a bunch of industry people, you know, the likes of like Monty Connor and Brian Slagle and Brian Binkeroff and all these guys and John Frank. And we were talking about that latest article that just came out about the death of guitar and mm-hmm. the decline of guitar sales with Gibson and Fender and what's going on and how Taylor Swift, believe it or not, Taylor Swift is one of the most influential guitarists of the last few years because right. she's up there holding a guitar, and it's inspired girls to pick up a guitar. But the fact of the matter is, the whole gist of this article and what we've been talking about, and it extends to metal, is the idea that you know, rap and hip hop is so big now, and electronic music is so big that, as I put it when we were debating with this email group, guitar to young kids these days is like French horn was to us coming up through school. Guitar is kind of like this foreign instrument that it may come around again, and it may take a guitar hero of some sort to come up. But right now, you know, guitars look like an old man's, you know, instrument of torture, you know, and a weapon. But it's not used very much to right. make music these days. It's about turntables and computers and you know, DJs and whatnot.
Yeah.
So where does metal fit right now? You know, the other thing we talked about with our email group is this idea it somehow morphed into a discussion about Vardis, and we realized, you know, there are bright spots all the time. There are weird little cultural things that happen, and right now one of the things is this whole new wave of British heavy / retro speed metal, slightly power metal, but dirtier towards biker metal, but, you know, basically new wave British heavy metal. There's a lot of young kids that are into that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, there is a very big question mark out right now about how many young people are into metal. And, you know, and that, you know, we circle right back to your original question. It's kind of a grave situation.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a son who's 17 years old, and basically anything that's not rap and pop is considered rock. It's
right.
all put into this category of rock, and it's considered a fossilized form of music. He makes no distinction about heavy metal or any of that stuff. Anything with anybody standing up there with a guitar and drums and a bass is rock.
Yeah.
And it's just this curious thing off to the side of the mainstream, because the mainstream is hip hop and rap.
Yeah. It's interesting though, the French horn analogy, because even with my son, you know, I was trying to get him interested in guitar, and just it was not cool to him, you know. He's decided to pick out a banjo, and that's what he's trying to learn, to play banjo, which to me, yeah. when I was a kid, that would have been totally not cool. But he doesn't, a guitar is not cool. Rock in general, I don't really think has the cool factor. I mean, I've heard people say, well, rock is kind of now what jazz was, you know, back in the 70s and 80s,
yes.
you know, and that's yeah. I think a really fair analogy and comparison.
Yeah, and you know, this whole discussion we had, and this is like long, I believe it's a Washington Post article that got reproduced in a few places. I think it was in our Toronto newspaper, and I get the New York Times, and I think it was in there as well. You know, it was all about how they're not selling very many guitars.
Yeah.
And then, you know, our group talked about Jack Endino as part of our group as well, the famous producer. And he talked about how he, three of his favorite guitars, he bought at like Goodwill for $19.99 and $25 and all stuff. And basically Japanese knockoffs of Fenders and whatnot. And he says, you know, part of this thing about guitars, like we can, you know, lament the death of rock, but part of it is that, you know, the world doesn't need more guitars, because
yeah.
guitars stick around and they become old and classic, and the old ones are actually thought to be cooler than the new ones.
That's a good point.
So, yeah. you know, they don't essentially often get trashed and thrown in the trash heap. They stick around. It's a little bit like, you know, how many hundred billion people have been on the earth, right?
Yeah.
It's the same sort of thing. I mean, how many more guitars need to be made? And especially again, how many guitars need to be made when, you know, the spotty history of Guitar Heroes since Randy Rhoads and Zakk Wylde and Eddie Van Halen reads somewhat like Jack White, John Mayer, Taylor Swift.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really spotty history, right?
Yeah.
There's just not a lot of, you know, what, Johnny Lang, Joe Bonamassa.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially the standard definition of a guitar hero, we haven't had one since the mid-80s.
Yeah, very true.
Right? But, you know, the optimistic voice says all it takes is one guy to come along and be famous and make people
cool.
Love the guitar again.
Yeah.
I mean, Kurt Cobain was one of those.
Right.
I mean, we're not talking about a virtuoso that worshipped the guitar. He worshipped the song, and he was great. But he also, influenced generations of guys to pick up the guitar, as did grunge in general. I mean, grunge was a swing back to the caveman aspect of guitar, bass, and drums.
Right on.
So, it's the state of metal. I guess to add another thing to it, I hate to drone, you know, I hope I'm not talking your ear off here I'm boring you to death, but, you know, the other thing about the state of metal, which is nice and cool, is that it is absolutely the frontier front edge of progressive rock. I mean, the greatest virtuosic playing in all of music these days, where it's more exciting as hell as anything, is taking place in metal with everybody, with guitarists, bassists, and drummers. I mean,
yeah.
metal is a very difficult thing to play. There,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of great metal being played and a lot of virtuosic players that it's almost like if they grow out of metal and go into progressive rock, they'll have no problem playing progressive rock because, you know, their feet have been put to the fire in competing with the levels that heavy metal demands of people these days.
Right on, definitely. Well, Martin, we're going to have to cut it there, but again, thank you for this great Motorhead book. I really, truly enjoyed reading it. And one thing that happens when I read your books, you know, I get so excited and about the catalog, and a lot of times I haven't listened to it for years and years, and it always gets me back into the music. And I just highly recommend all your books to our listeners out there. And again, we'll have your website up, link through the show notes, martinpopoff.com. And yeah, thanks so much, Martin.
All right. Thank you, Mark. This was fun again.
Yes.
I love talking to you. Well, hopefully we have many more to come.
Yeah. Well, AC/DC conversation, I'm sure, on the way soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We got to do that one.
Cool.
I see you gone to seed. The only reasons were your guilt and greed. You're out there on your own. Your face turned to stone. Whatever happened to your life? Stone dead forever. Time, there's a long, long wait, and I caught your fingers in the early gates. Better leave your number, and we'll call you. You know your problems ain't exactly new. The left side of the goal, your touch has turned to gold. Whatever happened to your life? Hey. Cut Tycoon, you're a sweet lamb lizard, great as a spoon, and I never had it quite so good, cause you didn't know that you even could, but your time has come today. Turns out 2 feet of clay.
Stone Dead Forever, 1979, off the Bomber record by Motorhead. Classic stuff there, produced by Jimmy Miller, who we mentioned during the interview. Definitely interesting guy, to say the least. Oh, thank you, Martin, for that. A Motorhead history lesson by the great Martin Popoff. Check out his books. Go to martinpopoff.com. The website will have it linked through today's show notes. Go buy that book. Do yourself a favor. Read that friggin' book. It's fucking awesome. Let's keep this going. This song right here is Back in the USSA. Not to be confused with the song Back in the USSR, which Lemmy covered. If you go to Spotify, you can find him covering that Beatles song without Motorhead, I believe. But anyways, this is Back in the USSA. This is off the brand new album by Barb Wire Dolls, which is called Rub My Mind. It's was released on Motorhead Records. Check it out. And we'll hear this song, and then we'll hear from Pin Doll from Barb Wire Dolls.
Hey, this is Mark Striegel, and we are talking with Pin Doll from Barb Wire Dolls. He's out on the road right now with Warped Tour, which you guys are about 2 days into the tour now, right, Pin?
Yeah, we played 2 dates already. But it's already our fifth sixth day on tour, because we had to drive seventh day. What am I saying? We had to drive all the way up to Seattle. Now we're driving back down, and we're arriving in Albuquerque, and so it's just nonstop. But it's great.
Cool. And this is, you're on the Warped Tour all summer long, right?
Yes, all dates, all summer long until it ends August 6th. So yeah, it's a big tour.
Yeah, you guys are going nonstop. You had new music out last year. You are constantly on the road touring, and more new music on the way. What, in just, I guess, a week or two, the brand new record will drop, Rub My Mind. We just heard Back in the USSA. Great track. I'm totally excited to hear the full album. Can you confirm the date of July 7th as the release date?
Yeah. The July 7th is the release date. And yeah, it was pushed back a few days, a few weeks, because, you know, record plants, you know, we had to get the vinyl out, got it on white vinyl. It looks really good. But yeah, Back in USA is the first single and video from the album. And the album's really, really great album. We're really stoked on it. We're really proud of it. That's why we had to get it out immediately, even though we released our album last year. Our first one was Motorhead Music. So yeah, great album.
And I want to talk about Motorhead Music and your involvement with that label. But first, let's talk about Rub My Mind. What studio did you guys record this at?
But it's really kind of important how we recorded it.
Yeah.
What happened was that we played Riot Fest in Chicago, and we were friends with Eagles of Death Metal, this band.
Sure.
And we were watching them and stuff, and we invited them to come back to Crete, Greece, where we live in an artist commune, to come and record some acoustic stuff and hang out, teach them how to surf. And they said, well, why don't you come to our studio in Joshua Tree called Rancho de la Luna? And we were like, Rancho de la Luna, oh my God, that's
famous,
like a legendary studio.
Yeah.
Where Queens of Stone Age, Caius the Desert Rock started, you know, Foo Fighters did their Sonic Highways thing there, PJ Harvey. We're like, oh my God, we want to be honored to come this. He said, oh, well, come by. So he wrote, Dave Catching the Guitarist wrote me and said, okay, you know, you're coming, you know, a few days later, whatever, a while back later, he's like, okay, you're coming November 23rd or 22nd or whatever. I forget what the date was now. And literally 10 minutes after we were stopped texting each other was when the Paris attacks happened in Bataclan and on the band.
Wow.
Horrible tragedy. So we didn't bother him for at least a week. We were just, you know, we were in awe of what's going on. Very just sad. And then he wrote us back and said, you're still coming in tomorrow, whatever, you know, next few days to come in and record. And we were like, are you sure he wants to come? And he said, yes, the music must go on. You must come.
Wow.
And so we were so inspired that we end up writing 7 more songs literally in 3 days and one at the studio. And we did it all in Rancho de la Luna in 2 days. We did the album in 2 days. We had to leave because Iggy Pop was coming in with Josh Homme to do their post-pop depression album.
Right.
But he gave us 2 days and we recorded the whole album in 2 days and really caught the desert vibe, the vibe of the world at the time, or, you know, the melancholy of what's happening in the world. And, you know, there's some political songs, but there's also some really moving, soul-steering songs that were written based on that situation, including a song called Desert Song. We had to be in there.
Right. Very cool. And was there a certain producer you were working with?
Yeah, we definitely went back with Jay Baumgartner, our producer of the last album called Desperate, because he's like another member of the band. He knows us so well, and he comes to our live shows. And he really, as soon as I told him we recorded, you know, recording at Rancho Luna, he said, I'm in. And I said, well, I don't even know if there's a budget for you or anything to help out. And he's like, I don't care. Wow. If it's Rancho Luna, I'm there. And he owns like the best studio in the world called Energy Studios in Hollywood, which everybody from Linkin Park to everybody's recorded there. It's like whatever. It's a huge Hollywood studio, world class. But as soon as he heard Rancho Luna, he's like, I got to be there. You know, I got to be part of this. So that's really great. And he made it sound fantastic. Actually, as we finished the album, Eagles of the Metal came to see the last song being mixed, and they heard Desert Song, and they just sat in silence, listened to it, and it was a very emotional moment, them hearing the song that we wrote based on how we felt after what happened to them and the world and the victims in Paris. So it's quite moving.
Wow.
We're still shaken up a little bit thinking about it.
Yeah, what an amazing story. I had no idea you had this connection with Eagles of Death Metal. That's a great story. And again, The record we're talking about is Rub My Mind. The band is Barbed Wire Dolls. We are talking with Pindall, the guitar player in the band. Just to kind of touch upon a few real cool things in your history. You know, you guys formed in Greece, as you mentioned, but I thought it was really kind of neat how you ended up in Los Angeles, in the States here. A real legendary guy, Rodney Bingenheimer. I guess he heard you guys over in Greece and somehow brought you over. How did it was the, what's his involvement?
It was the weirdest thing. It's 2010. We started our band. We couldn't get a show in the island of Crete, the whole island. Nobody would book us because we were like punk. They're afraid of punks. They think they're anarchists only, and they're going to bomb the house or something.
Right.
So we were really disappointed. We're like, wow. So we're going to Athens to play. And we're like, how are we ever going to get out of this world? And we found this movie called Mayor of Sunset Strip at a DVD store that was going out of business.
I love that movie.
We bought it for a dollar. Yeah, for a euro. We bought it for a euro. And we're like, oh my God, this guy, Rodney Bingenheimer, he's like the most famous DJ in America. He discovered everybody, started playing them. And we were like, oh my God, if he only could discover us, you know, in MySpace. And we didn't do anything. We just thought about it. And literally 2 weeks later, we get an email from his assistant, Cindy, says, Rodney discovered you on MySpace. He would love for you to send your demo if you have any music you have. And we're like, yes, we just recorded a demo. So we sent it to him. He started playing it nonstop, and he invited us to L.A. for a show. So we were like, well, let's do it. So we sold everything we owned. I'm a professional surfer, so I had my own surfboard model. So I just got six new boards, you know, with everything on there, and they're worth a lot of money. So I sold those. I didn't even tell the shape. I was like, sorry, I just sold them all. Wow. We bought tickets. We went to L.A. We meet Rodney at Canner's Deli, where he always hangs out. And he says, you have to go to the Sunset Strip to go see the Whiskey. That's the most legendary club in the world, apart from CBGB's, which I know, of course. So we're there, and that's where we run into Lemmy walking on the street. And we become friends with Lemmy just through the years, but he never saw us live. And then in 2015, he was looking for a band to put out on his label with his record company partners. And he turned down 64 bands. He was really searching for somebody. And everybody sounded like Motorhead, I guess. And he didn't want that. And he saw us and just said, you guys want to be on Motorhead Music? And we said, yes. And so it's a very weird, the first night in L.A., we were with Rodney and Lemmy. And then, you know, 5 years later, we're signed to Motorhead Music because of Lemmy, because Rodney told us to go to the Whiskey at Go-Go. So it's a very surreal, weird experience.
Yeah.
And we ended up, we couldn't leave America for 2.5 years because we had no money to go back home. And we just illegally played all across the country for 2.5 years playing shows. And then we finally went to Europe, and we rarely see our home, maybe once every 2 years.
So, but in between that time, you know, when Lemmy signed you and you first came over and met Rodney, and Rodney, you know, kind of, I guess, indirectly introduced you to Lemmy by sending you to, you said, where, with the Whiskey, right? Was that where he was, or the Rainbow?
Yeah.
Yeah, Whiskey, okay.
He told us to go to the Whiskey, but we saw him as we were walking past the Whiskey towards the Rainbow.
Oh, I got you. Okay, cool.
He was on the, he must have been walking somewhere. I don't know where he was going.
But in that five-year period, I mean, a lot of stuff happened for you guys. It was just, what, constant touring? I mean, you worked with legendary people like Steve Albini recording stuff. I mean, is there just quickly, like, the two-minute summary of that 5 years for you guys? What was going on?
It was like Black Flag's Henry Rollins book, Get in the Van. We literally played about 400 shows, living out of the van, living out of people's houses, squatting at people's houses left and right, breaking down everywhere left and right, having to get stuck in cities for 3 months at a time, playing every week to make money to book the next tour. And then we recorded with Steve Albini because he liked the band, and he gave us 2 days to come and record out of his schedule that was booked. And we raised money through our fans, gave us some money to record most of it. And that came out, and the press went crazy saying, you know, like the best punk band in 20 years. And everybody loved that album, and it got us to Europe, and we started touring Europe nonstop. And we toured on that album for 3 years. We never had the time to even record another album, you know, because we had to survive by touring. And that's pretty much it. And then it's getting kind of the same old, except our music's constantly changing. That's all.
And, nice. You know,
And that's it.
Yeah. Now, Motorhead Music, obviously, we lost the great Lemmy Kilmister, but Motorhead Music, the label, is still continuing on. Are there any significant people we might know behind it, running it?
Well, what happened is he, with his longtime manager, Todd Singerman, who'd been with for 25 years, I guess, and the label that had been putting their music out for decades, they started, you know, their label was Motorhead Music. They released Motorhead albums. They started it. They were always putting up with the same label, but they finally started the name Motorhead Music, I guess, years ago. And Lemmy is a big supporter of bands. He really, you know, helps bands. You know, he's helped so many bands along the way from, you know, you name it. And he really was disgusted with the music scene. He kept telling everybody, you know, what's going on? I can't stand the music that's out there. You know, if nobody's going to sign these bands, let's sign somebody. So they all started looking for him, presenting bands to him, I guess. And we got somehow by serendipity, somebody said they're playing the Whiskey tonight. He said, oh my God, I'm there. So we came. And as far as I know, you know, it's all the people that worked with Motorhead and promoted Motorhead. There's nobody new. And we even, right. Even his agents took us on, you know.
Well,
I mean, Todd, the manager, took us on. He said, look, if Lemmy said, good, I'm taking you on. I said, well, you got to see us live. He's like, I trust Lemmy. I said, okay, I know you trust Lemmy, but you got to come see us live before you want to work with us. And he did. And he said, oh my God, you know, now I see what Lemmy saw. So it was really great that he saw that. But it's the same thing. All the Lemmy, you know, fans, you know, Motorhead bangers, they all come to our shows curious, saying, you know, I know you're not like Motorhead, but you're like Lemmy's, you know, love child, musical child,
right?
You know, trying to keep the legacy going. So we're really curious, and after the show they're like, yeah, we really dig your band, you've got it going, and you know, we'll be behind you. So we're really grateful for that. I mean, it's the highest honor, hugest honor, to have Lemmy approve you. I mean, there's nobody higher than him in our world when it comes to rock and roll, you know.
Absolutely.
No one's seen it more. No one knows more about everything. I'm not talking just rock and metal, just everything. I mean, so it's, you know, it's too bad that, you know, well, he went away, passed away, you know, nicely. He was at peace. But, you know, he left a legacy, and, you know, nobody can fulfill that, especially us. But we'll definitely, you know, create our own legacy under his umbrella and love. You know, we asked ourselves, what would Lemmy do all the time?
Right on, right on. So, you've had just an amazing history. I mean, in these past 7 years since you've been here in the States, I mean, it's quite intense. Now, can I ask you, are you originally from Greece?
Yes, I'm full Greek. I went to American schools.
Oh, okay.
For many years. And I've lived in L.A. and Venice many times.
Yeah, because your accent, I mean, I barely even hear an accent. You know,
there's no accent anymore. It's,
right.
If you hear my parents, then you know.
Right.
I can speak Greek all you want. So
right. Okay.
I think English is easier to understand.
Right. I got you. And you still surf? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Whenever we're not on tour, every day, it's pretty much we all go. It's our detoxing. It's our way of relaxing because we're busy all the time. Writing songs and working and making clothes. Our singers making clothes, and so surfing is our relaxation, my way of staying in balance between music and what I love.
Awesome, Pin. It's been great talking with you. I really enjoyed your stories, and I'm totally psyched to hear the full record. Again, we've heard the single, which is Back in the USSA. We'll have it linked through today's show notes, the YouTube video of it. But the full record drops just in a couple weeks, probably in about a week by the time we get this up, on July 7th.
Yeah.
It's called Rub My Mind, out on Motorhead Music. And again, the band, Barb Wire Dolls. We have been speaking with Pin Dahl, the guitarist in the band. Pin, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. Rock on, brother. Peace and peace. Thank you very much.
Okay, take care, man.
Big thanks to Pin Dahl for checking in with us here on Talking Metal. Thanks to Martin Popoff. Thanks to you guys for supporting what we do. Hope to see you in Nashville on August 26th. If you want to co-host a show, leave us a $75 donation on that GoFundMe page I mentioned earlier, gofundme.com/rock, the letter N, Pod Expo, and we'll hook it up. You don't have to go to Nashville to co-host. We can do it via Skype, But what you do have to do is support what we're doing in Nashville with that $75 donation. I get not one penny of it. I'm paying for my own way out there, paying for my own hotel rooms. It's all just to support podcasting and what these guys are doing. Chris from Decibel Geek has kind of spearheaded the whole thing. So, yeah, you know the drill. Let's support. Let's show some love, some podcasting love. And let's shake your blood here on Talking Metal. Until next time, guys. This is Lemmy on bass and vocals, Dave Grohl on guitar and drums from 2004 off the Probot album. This is Shake Your Blood. See you next time.